Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 349. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
That's me.
James Jones.
It's not 350.
Not yet. John Lindemann.
Johnny, it's my pleasure.
Hey, man. And Justin Berube is our special guest this week.
What's up, guys?
Yeah.
You might remember Justin from some of the shows we did at E3. He's been on Connectivity a few times, and we got him in here on very short notice. He's been very gracious to help us out this week because John, through some unfortunate life events out of his control, has not been able to play Pandora's Tower yet. Hopefully that will change by the time we wrap up the retroactive in a couple of weeks. But for now, we brought in Justin to help us talk about it in the second part of this show. And he was available for new business as well. So we said, hey, come on. He's actually got a couple of relevant games to talk about here in a little bit. But I'm going to kick off new business because apparently, I'm surprised, but apparently I'm the only one here. Or not the only one, but apparently I've played the most of Rayman Legends at this point. I played it for a couple hours last night. And it's the newest Wii U game. Wonderful 101 comes out next week, so hopefully one of us will be talking about that soon. It's already out in the rest of the world. But regardless, Rayman Legends, has been, I guess, one of my most anticipated Wii U games. I was never super crazy about it the way some people were from that original demo a couple years ago at E3, but I thought it was really fun. And then over time, I guess in that amount of time, I played Rayman Origins not too long after that. And so then I got a lot better feel for why people were excited about it. And I really liked Origins, and I'm hopeful that I'm going to like Legends even more. Some of the stuff I've read about it makes it sound like maybe it's slightly less difficult, especially near the end, or at least it ramps up in a more natural way. There's a number of other things. And of course, it makes really good use of the Wii U gamepad. In a way that not many games have done up to this point. And so I'm excited about that too. And from what I've played of the demo as well as the first few levels of the game last night, I think, that it definitely holds up to that. I think the touchscreen stuff is really inventive and interesting. It's a relatively small part of the game. It's like a section of a larger level, or every now and then there might be a level, a kind of a short level that's entirely touch-based. But it seems to work well, even in single player, which is the way I'm doing it. And, the rest of the game is very much in line with Rayman Origins. It is a really fast-paced, sort fairly linear 2D platformer. It's challenging. It's, the character has really interesting sort of physics to the way he moves, and the enemies are very funny, and the artwork is just absolutely glorious to behold. I mean, it to me, Legends looks significantly better than Origins, which is already a very beautiful game. And certainly in terms of 2D artwork, I haven't played anything remotely like this on Wii U. And there are some polygons as well, but they're used in a way so that it's hard to tell that they're polygons. Except, there's some 3D models in some of the cutscenes that go in and out of the screen, and they turn and they animate in a way that you can't really do with 2D sprites. So those are polygons, but you would have to infer that because the modeling is so good that it looks just like all the 2D artwork, which is really impressive. Mm. But I've noticed there seem to be more layers of parallax in this game versus the predecessor. So there's stuff that seems more close to the screen. It actually reminds me a little bit of Muramasa, in the way that there seem to be multiple layers and they're all sort of moving all the time, so there's water sort of ebbing and flowing, or there's grass that's blowing in the wind. In this case, I mean, you've even got pieces of the level that are sort of alive and they move up and down, and they really have this kind of living, jittery animation to them, and they move in even the different pieces of the ground as they move. They're on different layers, and so they sort of move. It's very strange, but it just looks absolutely incredible, and it really surprised me, even though I expected Rayman Legends to be a beautiful game. It's actually in playing the final version and playing it, you know, on my TV, on my Wii U, it looks even better than I could have imagined. So, Justin, you got to play a little bit of it, didn't you?
I did play a little bit.
What are your initial impressions?
I was playing multiplayer. I haven't really played single player. I was playing with my sister and her friend, so I was on the gamepad. Having a lot of fun. My sister's a music major, actually, and she says it's some of the best video game music she's ever heard.
It's really nice, yeah.
Yeah, she's very impressed with the soundtrack. But I'm enjoying the game with multiplayer. My only problem is that I have to be Murphy. They won't let me, like, switch, so there's times when I don't want to be using the touch screen all the time. I wish I could pass it off in an easier fashion. But overall, I'm very happy with it, what I've played. I really like the way the gamepad is being used in the game, like you mentioned earlier.
Now, if you're playing multiplayer and you're on the gamepad, can you use Murphy throughout the whole game, or do you only get to participate when Rayman reaches one of these sections that's really designed around having Murphy on the touchscreen?
I'm pretty sure you can switch to Murphy at any time you'd like. There's a few areas I've gotten to where it forces you to be Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
But you could switch between actually playing on the TV as your chosen character or Murphy at any time, and there are benefits to that. So if you're like going through with multiple people, I guess you're collecting the lums. If you rub your finger over the lums on the gamepad, they become purple lums, and therefore worth more. So if you're trying to hit those high scores for each level, if you do it with multiple people, it's a lot easier since you can increase the value of the lums without collecting them in a specific order, as long as you rub your finger over them on the gamepad.
Wow.
I don't suppose that either of you guys bothered to check the demo for, you know, the other versions, the 360 or PS3?
It's button presses. That's how they replace all the touchscreen stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just, like, you read the reviews, and I guess you really have to know the reviewer because opinions are all over the place. And some people actually prefer the button press, and other people prefer the touchscreen. Jeremy Parrish, for some reason, just hated those sections on the Wii U and says, oh, it's much more manageable on the other consoles.
I mean, the touchscreen controls, just even last night, I had a couple of times when they just didn't respond. And
oh, really?
I don't think that's the game's fault. I just think, I've said this many times, I don't think the gamepad touchscreen is all that great. Especially when you're using your finger. At some point, I actually pulled out the stylus because I wanted a little more affirmation that, yes, verily, I am touching the screen hard enough for it to register. And that was an improvement, but I kind of would rather not do that. And of course, you know, all the iconography in the game is a finger, you know, so it seems like they want you to use your finger or they expect you to. But, you know, it's a pressure sensitive, resistive touch screen, and it's just not as sensitive as a capacitive screen. So, you know, if you're worried about that, maybe get the Vita version, I guess, because it does have the touch screen gameplay. It's missing some other things, but.
Yeah, but are you, like, in terms of the flow of the game, do you think that those sections put the game to a grinding halt, or?
No. They're a little slower than normal parts of the game, I would say, but not much, and they're still faster than you might expect from that style of gameplay where you're no longer directly controlling the character. You're sort of, it's a little bit more like Lemmings, you know, because mm-hmm. at least in single player, you've got Glowbox, I think is the green character's name, Rayman's friend, and he's right. Moving automatically through these levels. And so you're sort of trying to move things out of the way before he gets there. And he's smart enough to not, he's not going to jump into a pit, you know, just because you haven't put a platform there, he'll wait. But then I played a level last night where there's like a wall of fire chasing him. So if you wait too long or if you're too slow to move the different things around to allow him to proceed, then you'll have to start over at the beginning. So there is some pressure, and I would say there's a lot of pressure in trying to do these things correctly. And there's also, it's not always that punitive. Sometimes there's not anything chasing you, but if you want to get certain bonuses, you need to set up a sort of chain reaction of things early enough that he gets to something at the right time. And sometimes you can do it too early. So there's a certain, right. There's a certain visual language in those levels that I think takes some time to get used to so that you learn when you need to cut the ropes or when you need to move the platforms in order to, you know, to get him up to the secret place where you can get a bonus character or whatever. But I think they're really fun, and I don't think they're that slow paced or that much different in terms of pacing from the regular part of the game. Now, Jeremy's played a lot more of it than me, so I'm not disputing his assessment of it, but right. So far, I think they're fun. I mean, I thought they were fun at E3 a couple years ago. I thought they were fun in the demo that was released for everybody earlier this year, and I think they're fun in the final game.
Cool.
Yeah, so I'm really liking it so far. I gotta say, this seems really nitpicky, but the sort of hub world where you choose the level that you want to go into, it's almost like it's kind of harkening back to Super Mario 64, because it's just got, and the demo had this, or the Challenges app had this also. But you know, it's got just, the levels are represented as just sort of paintings up on an easel. And you just walk over to it and you jump, and Rayman gets sucked into it. I feel like that's not a very artistic way to sort of preview the levels, or to sort of attract you to playing different levels, because the artwork is for the level is pretty small on the screen on that, you know, on that painting. You can't really see much of it, and they're trying to fit like the name of it and sort of a logo on top of it as well. So the whole thing is just really cramped, and they're small enough that they can fit 3 or 4 of these paintings on the screen at any given time. And I feel like it's just not, I mean, it made sense in Mario 64, but also in that game, because it's in 3D, you can walk right up to the painting and make it fill up the whole screen if you want to. And in this game, you know, you can't control the zoom, so everything is kind of, I don't know, it's just, it feels like there's got to be a more vibrant way to sort of say, hey, this is what this level looks like, or this is what this level is all about. Don't you want to come play it? It seems a little bit dry. In a game where everything is so lush and so vibrant, so colorful, it's just a little bit surprising to me. I don't think it's a great interface, but, you know, whatever. It's really not important.
At least each level has a funny pun in the name, right?
And they do.
Like, aren't they kind of descriptive?
Sort of. Yeah. Yeah, sort of. I mean, it's about as clever as maybe, like, Yoshi's Island. So, I don't know.
Right. Touch fuzzy, get dizzy.
nothing super special so far that I've seen. But anyway, Rayman Legends, it seems great. I wish I had a lot more time to play it this week, but it just hasn't worked out that way. But I'm excited to play more of it. And I'm excited to have, you know, yet another really interesting Wii game. We've had a few lately, both on the eShop and in retail, and, you know, Wonderful 101. I'm not sure it's going to be my cup of tea, but it seems like some people will definitely really be into that. And it does feel like we're starting to pick up some steam, you know, at least for those of us who already have the system. It's finally giving us something fun to play on it. So I'm really happy about that. Guillaume, why don't you go next with another brand new Wii game?
Yeah, I'm set to review the Gianna Sisters Twisted Dreams for the Wii U. And so I started that last night. I got the code pretty late. And it's just released today on Thursday in North America. I gotta say, like, initially, you've talked about this game before because you've had it on Steam.
Yeah.
But initially I thought, like, wow, yes, this is what I want. This is a really, really good game. The graphics are really pretty. Perhaps, like, the art is a little bit busy. You know, it's a little bit hard to see exactly where the obstacles are. So that's unfortunate. Sometimes, like, you know, like, they try to call attention to hazards with certain colors. Like, you'll have, like, purple mist around thorny vines, and that's, you know, that says stay away. But there's other things around that are kind of purpley or misty, and it's just, you know, it doesn't help you that much.
I know exactly the part that you're talking about, and I had the same issue with it.
Right. But otherwise, like, it's just, like, really vibrant, really colorful. And the game controls well. Initially, you're just jumping around. It's the only ability. Very quickly in the first stage, you start having the option to hover, basically, kind of like What's Her Face in Donkey Kong Country 2.
Oh, yeah, Trixie.
I prefer What's Her Face.
It's Dixie in Donkey Kong Country 2, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It's right. Female Kong. Generic.
Exactly. But yeah, like, it's the exact same move. Like, she's spinning and she floats slowly. And you can also switch between worlds, and you've talked about, like, the effect, like, the entire world changes. Like, every prop basically in a game turns into, it goes from this, you know, happy land with owls everywhere smiling to, like, this hell with demons in it. But it's always like, it's always two sides of the same coin. Like, I mean, it's always the same level, but things like certain details change.
Mm-hmm.
And, when you turn into that other world, you also switch characters. And, so you've got the evil, I don't know if she's evil, the edgy sister.
Yeah.
Their names are never actually said in the manual or in the game. So I'm, you know, let's just call her like Redhead. So yeah, Redhead is just, you know, more edgy, and she can, turn into a fireball. And, if you, you know, you can kind of aim your fireball at enemies, and when you kill an enemy, you can keep the fireball going.
Mm-hmm.
Or in certain spots, when you've got two walls really close together, you can, use your fireball at an angle, and you're just gonna bounce, on the walls and keep going that way indefinitely. And it's really, really cool. Like, it's almost Sonic-like.
It's really fast, like a pinball kind of a bounce.
Yeah, yeah. So that's pretty cool. And I found the level design pretty clever. Like, you have to collect gems all over the place. And there are secrets. There are, you know, all sorts of nooks and crannies to discover. And you will have to solve kind of simple platforming puzzles to get to certain places. And, I find those really, really, like, challenging and really interesting. So, you know, in a way, like, this game has everything that I like about platformers. But at the same time, as I kept playing, the further I got, the longer the levels got. And it comes to a point at level around, like, 1-6, where the levels become so sprawling and so difficult and so huge that it's just, it just becomes tedious. Like, all of a sudden, like, I went from in the first level from having to collect like 300 gems to having to collect more than 600. At the end, there is a boss, and I died like 58 times in that level.
Yeah, the first boss is really hard.
Yeah, and I just, I'm not really enjoying that anymore. I guess it's kind of the way that, I guess that's what people mean by a European platformer. You know, a lot of them seem to have a focus on sprawling level design and lots of doodads collect. Like, I haven't played much, but like Super Turrican had like maybe like 5 levels, but they took like half an hour to get through.
Yeah, James Pond is like that.
Oh God, don't you talk about James Pond.
Yeah, they're definitely designed in a different way. I mean, and it's the same thing where like, you know, they almost have that garish look to them.
Yeah, there's so much visual.
Yeah.
Like, they want you to just look at it and go, ugh.
Yeah, it's been that way since the mid-80s. I don't know why.
If you think about the era, that makes sense from what, you know, visual design was like in the mid-80s, where it was just, I'm going to scream at you with colors.
Yep.
Because of the cocaine.
Exactly.
Probably. But yeah, like, I just went from really, really enjoying the game to being kind of sick of it. And that happened relatively quickly. So yeah, I don't know, I'm trying to find a way to keep enjoying this game, and I just find it tedious at this point. I don't really want to be scouring levels for 45 minutes before finding the exit, and dying over and over again in the process. I'm becoming quite frustrated with it.
Yeah, but, I mean, to be fair, there are lots of checkpoints, and you have unlimited lives. And you don't have to gather a certain number of gems just to open the exit. You just have to get to the exit and find it.
Right, but like, you need a certain number of gems to unlock the boss of the world. I don't know. Like, I'm trying to communicate the fact that I do enjoy finding the secrets. I just wish that the levels weren't so sprawling. You know,
yeah,
like
I agree with that. I think they are a bit too big, but it's not like they make you try to get all the way through it in one life or something like that. I mean, they're not big in a stressful way, except that I think it is probably possible to get lost. And the gems are kind of a guide to help you find your way around. And the gems always point you towards interesting places or maybe the next important place along the path towards the exit. But if you're going back into a level, then those gems won't be there because you already picked them up. And so, you know, then it might really feel like, wow, this is just really kind of wide open and I don't know which direction to go into. But that's kind of why I would recommend not going back into a level to get more gems until you actually need to.
And Actually, like most of the time, the levels will prevent you from backtracking. So it's not really the problem.
Right,
it's,
it closes off behind you.
Mm-hmm.
In the old 2D style.
Yeah, it's just that in the, like at the beginning of a level, they just go on for too long.
I would agree they're too long.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
But yeah, like otherwise, like the level design is good. There's just too much of it. It feels weird to say.
That's fair. All right, so look forward to your review next week. But for now, we're going to move on to Justin, who's also playing a new release. Although I guess this one's
on 3DS. Yes, it is on 3DS. It's Summer Carnival 92 Rekka. I hadn't heard of this game until recently. Yeah, Summer Carnival 92 Rekka. Apparently...
So this is kind of the inspiration for carnival games on a Wii?
No, it's very different.
Yeah, you're wrong.
All right, so I guess this game was some sort of competition cartridge in Japan. It's some shooting game festival in 1992. I don't know much about it. As soon as I heard about it, I was really interested in it because NES is my favorite system, and I never heard of this game since it's Famicom exclusive. So I downloaded it today. I've been playing it. So it's a top-down space shooter. There's a that's vertically scrolling.
It's a space shooter. Seriously, it sounds like it would be some sort of sports game, like the summer of '92
no,
Olympics.
No, John,
or
in Japanese carnivals, you often go in space.
It's a shoot 'em up, but because of the name and the '92, I had assumed this was a Super Famicom game. I can't believe it's a Famicom game released in 1992.
Well, you have to also remember. That the NES and SNES were kind of coexisting together. There's still games being released as the SNES was out, so I don't think it's that surprising.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that Wii U and Wii are coexisting right now.
Well, in Japan, the Famicom had a much longer
I think
tail.
Here, I'd say it did too. There's still, like, Mega Man games being released.
No, the Japanese Famicom
the last forever. The last NES game published by Nintendo, I think, was Wario's Woods in 95, if I'm not
mistaken. Well, I mean, Mega Man was, like, the Madden of...
Anyway, so 90. This game is extremely difficult. Only made it to about level 2.5. There's so much stuff on screen, but the impressive thing is, with how many sprites are being tossed on screen, I don't really see any slowdown at all. So if this is a perfect port, I'd be pretty impressed if that's how it actually played. There's a couple modes. There's just this regular story mode. I guess there is a story. It doesn't really show you, but the manual went over it, and it's pretty generic, so I'm not going to go into that. And there's also a score attack and a time attack, which give you like a different level to play on. I don't know too much about those yet because I've only been playing the single player, but there's different power-ups, two shooting buttons. The A button, I guess, has the extra stuff you pick up, shoot different power-ups, so I guess they're like bonus things that fly next to your ship. I'm sure you've seen them in different games, things like that. But then you pick up different...
Mm-hmm. Like the options.
Then you can pick up your main power-up, which you shoot with the B button. But there's... What I've noticed just recently, if you don't shoot, you actually get points. Then that's with the B button, so you can spam A all you want and hold it down. If you don't shoot, you get points. If you hold B, you only get points if you actually kill things. So it kind of gives you a risk versus reward system there. So it doesn't want you to just be spamming shots the entire time, because then you're not going to get the optimal score. But additionally, if you don't shoot, you kind of get this slow-building shield on the front of the ship, this circular energy ball, and then it charges up, and once it charges up all the way, you can shoot it with the B button, and it kind of explodes in the middle of the screen. It'll suck up any energy that's being shot at you, so there's a lot of strategy involved, and I guess memorizing the levels to really get it down, but it is difficult, and I'm loving it because I'm a gaming masochist, I guess. I like to be challenged, and I try to push the envelope of my skills. So, if you want a game you're probably not going to find anywhere else, and you want a challenge, this is something good to buy. It's only $5, so I think it's a good deal.
So how long is it?
I think it's 4 levels, but to get through those 4 levels is probably going to take you a while.
You will never see the end of this game.
You know, now I'm just curious. I'm most curious about this stuff where, you know, usually it's just like, you know, kind of a one-shot deal where you play through and, you know, you play your one area and then that's it, whatever score you have at the end of that.
Oh, you mean in these competitions?
Yeah, in these competitions. It strikes me as kind of strange they would have actually four.
Well, I mean, they could do it as rounds.
Areas.
It could have been like first round, true. That was everybody's, and then they picked the best.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there is one more gameplay mechanic I forgot to mention.
Yeah?
If you press press the select button, you can actually change how fast your ship will move. And I found this is very useful. There's some bosses where you want to move slow and kind of like stay in between their rapidly firing shots. So you kind of need to like get stuck in between them. And other times you want to move much faster. So there's like four or five speeds you can toggle between. So.
That's pretty cool. I mean, Gradius always did that, but it was a power up and you had to sort of manage when you got faster and when you sort of, and also it was a linear progression, so you could slow down, but only by getting up to the maximum speed and then using speed power up again to reset yourself all the way back down to the bottom, which usually happened by accident in my experience.
Yeah.
But that, I like the idea of you just being able to change that anytime. You know, it's like, clearly didn't have analog control back on Famicom, but like that's a way for you to sort of, like you said, just sort of manage your movement and be a little more precise. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time, that's kind of a one-way trip. I mean, you get faster and faster and faster, and then the only way you can slow down is if you die.
Right.
Which can be kind of annoying because you can actually wind up going too fast for some areas, even as areas change within them.
This is really intriguing, like more than I would have expected, because I don't really think of NES or Famicom as being like a good system for shoot 'em ups. I feel like a lot of them really chugged on that hardware and they didn't get really good until the 16-bit era, especially with TurboGrafx and Genesis. But also there was a few good ones on Super Nintendo as well.
Yeah.
And then 32-bit is probably where they really shined and peaked. But this one sounds like it runs pretty well. It sounds like it has some really complex mechanics. Like the thing about it encouraging you to not just shoot indiscriminately all the time. I'm always shocked that more shoot 'em ups don't do things like that, because a lot of them it feels like, you know, you might as well just make shooting automatic, because I'm never going to not do it. I have no reason to stop shooting ever.
It's very difficult, though. I mean, it's best to do that, but there's so much stuff happening, you're like scared to stop shooting at times.
Sure,
so I guess
Ikaruga was like that too. But if you could train yourself to be a little more judicious with your shots, you can get a lot higher score, you know. So if you're to the point where just surviving is no longer your primary challenge and you're more worried, you feel like you can survive, you're more worried about score attack, then you can take advantage of stuff like that. It's like, it's optional, right?
Definitely.
So I like that. And I like the idea that because this is on Virtual Console, you can use save states. Because the one thing that really drives me crazy...
If you're a cheater.
Say what?
If you're a cheater.
Oh, I am absolutely a cheater. And the thing that drives me crazy about these old shoot-em-ups is that I end up, especially the harder they are, the more I end up just kind of playing the first or second level over and over again. And it feels like I'm getting better, but it takes so long and it's so difficult to even get to the place where I was before. That I never really get a chance to improve on the parts that are giving me the most difficulty towards the end. So being able to use save states to just say, well, I got past the first level, I'm going to make a save state, and now I can really focus on the second level, and then and so on. That's very appealing to me because I'm not a hardcore shoot 'em up fan, but I do like them.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean,
it's a good way to learn the level.
Yeah, and it's more fun than, you know, doing even training modes or something like that.
Right, yeah. Training modes are like, eh...
Yeah.
Yeah, Ikaruga has a training mode. I never really felt like it was useful or fun. So I like that idea a lot. All right, cool, man. So let's move on quickly to John Lindemann.
All right. Well, you know, I've kind of been saying over the past couple of weeks, Final Fantasy XIV. That still has not happened because they still really haven't sorted out their login stuff and character creation
stuff. God, Square Enix.
I am bound and determined to create my character on the server that I want, and that server has yet to actually open up character creation. So, you know, I'm perfectly intent. I mean, I have obviously plenty of other stuff to play, so I'm perfectly content to kind of wait it out. You know, they've extended, I think they've added 7 days onto your kind of free trial. You get a 30-day free trial, obviously, before you have to pay. So,
But you pay for the game, it's like a $50 game, right?
Yeah, yep. Yep.
So you pay for the disc or the download, and then you start paying a subscription.
Yeah. So you kind of, you kind of subsidize your first month of play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but yeah, so, you know, I still even haven't even logged on, but that's really not what I came here tonight to talk about. So, you know, this whole Wii U price drop, let's talk about that for a moment. So, you know, it came to my attention earlier this week that that the whole Zelda bundle is not just a GameCube, it's not just a GameStop exclusive, That it's actually being sold on Best Buy. But
yes.
Really, more importantly, it's being sold on Newegg.
Right.
Newegg, now, unlike Amazon, with this just changed last week, where Amazon is now charging tax in the state of Georgia, Newegg does not. So therefore, I pre-ordered the Zelda bundle from Newegg.
Oh, snap.
So, yep, it's going to be on my way. And so, yeah, it's going to be slow shipping, so, you know, I won't get it.
I actually pre-ordered it, too.
Yep. Yeah, and,
yeah, but you already have a Wii U, Justin.
I just bought my second Wii U today, actually. I got the white one for a decent price.
Yeah, you are the guy. We mentioned it last week. You are the guy who will own two Wii Us.
Yep.
Yes, that's me.
So John, when are you getting it? Is it like early October?
It'll be late September. It'll probably take about five to six days to get here. Oh, okay. I think. Not too long though. Usually they're pretty good about shipping.
Yep.
But I mean, shipping was only $5, so I'm getting it for $305.
Nice.
Out the door.
And you could probably pick up Nintendo Land for $5 somewhere too.
Yeah, but well, what I am going to do, the first two games I'm going to buy are New Super Mario Brothers U.
Sure.
And I'm going to get Monster Hunter. Those are the first two on my list.
Shocked.
Yep.
Shocked.
So.
Good combo for you.
Yep. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. And also, of course, I'm going to pick up Earthbound as soon as I possibly can. But
oh, yes.
So I'm really looking forward to, you know, really, like, the more I think about it, the more the off-TV play really, really excites me. So
it's, and I mean, it'll be really excellent for stuff like Earthbound.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Mario, I think, can occasionally be somewhat more difficult to play on the gamepad just because the display is so much smaller, and it's, that game is really built around being played on a big TV. You know, the graphics are pretty detailed mm-hmm. at times, and it's very fast-paced, especially the yeah. Luigi game. But Earthbound is yep. just so perfect for off-TV play, and I would have played a lot more of it by now, except I just haven't had time. There's been also just been so many damn new games coming out. Like, this is my Christmas. I feel like in November, there's not actually that much stuff coming out that I'll be interested in. Like maybe one or two games, but I feel like a lot of the stuff that I'm really excited about has been coming out just in the past month.
Yeah.
So it's been a little overwhelming for me. I've got a lot of games that I haven't actually played yet, like brand new games, which is a little upsetting, but yeah. I'll catch up.
It's perfect for me because I'm kind of coming at it in the same way that I came at the 3DS, where even though there's not a huge amount of, games out there that I'm necessarily looking at, there's a couple that I really, really want, and they'll tide me over well into next year when, mm-hmm. you know, when the heavy hitters start coming out. So
we hope.
Right.
I'm looking forward to it. And also, I'll also have Wind Waker HD. Not a bad game to throw in there as a bonus, which I'm looking forward to more I think about it. So
it'll definitely, be a good time sink.
Yep. For sure.
That's a big game. It's one of the longest games released on Wii U.
Yeah.
So far.
Well, it's
will be.
It's a fantastic parallel to what 3DS had at about this point in its life with the 3DS remake of Ocarina of Time, which people bought because, like, oh, good, I'll have a long game on my Wii U or on my 3DS. And that's the only reason I bought the dumb game, was because I wanted to have a long game.
I definitely get the appeal, especially if you haven't played the original. All right, man. Well, that's good news. It's very, very good news for the podcast, and it's good news for you as well.
Bad news for our trolls, though.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, look forward to hearing your impressions of it, man. And Final Fantasy 14 as well, if Square ever gets their shit together.
I hope they never
do. One day. Like,
I know we used to have this long-standing joke about me always wanting John to talk about MMOs, but I am very, very legitimately curious about FF14. I've heard a lot of things about it, and I really don't know how to sort through it all. So, John, you're going to be my Sherpa, because, like, if ever there was an MMO that might actually pull me in and get me to actually try an MMO, it's Final Fantasy 14. I mean, it's any Final Fantasy if they do it right. If they make it, and it sounds like they've really tried in this case to do it right after all. So
yeah, well, I recommended it to Matt Walker. You know, he really liked it because he was kind of on the fence too. He was like, you know, I don't know, I might jump in. You know, and I said, hey man, I can tell you this. It's, you know, I mean, it's not gonna change your life. And even in terms of MMOs, what it does is pretty basic. I mean, it's typical, right?
Right.
It's not really reinventing the wheel or anything. But I said, what it does is it really gives you that kind of feel, you know? It has all those little, has all that kind of fan service stuff that people are looking for, which the other game didn't really have.
The other game being the same game, or at least a game with the same name.
Well, 1.0 didn't have that kind of stuff to the degree that 2.0 does.
Can we just, like, so, I was saying this before the show, can we just refer to this as Final Fantasy 14 too? Just for the sake of the podcast, can we call it that?
Yeah, it is more so than actually than, you know, any of the other hyphen twos out there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. All right, man. Well, that sounds good. And we're going to move on right now to what James has been playing.
Yep. So I have been enjoying the incredibly slow and tedious trickle of free games for Xbox Gold members. And by slow, I mean ridiculous. I think they're on their only second or third game. And it's keep in mind this was announced, what, back at E3?
It started at E3,
it's not been great. It's not been it. But, so I got Dead Rising 2. The reason I never bought Dead Rising 2 was I bought Dead Rising 1, and I've talked about it on the show years ago. And
I can't remember if you actually liked it or not.
I was ambivalent until it got to the boss battles, and then I just hated it.
Yeah.
I just felt like it lacked. I know it was an open world game, and a lack of direction is part of the implicit design, but it lacked direction in such an extreme way that it was disorienting. But there was so much wandering around. It because there's really nowhere safe to just sort of stand and get your bearings, really, because the whole world is full of fucking zombies. Mm-hmm. You feel like you need to be kinetic. Things need to be happening. But a lot of times you're just sort of wandering around and you're like, oh yeah, I can't go through there. Those jackasses on the Jeep are there with machine guns. So like just going along around, it just really wasn't much fun. Like it got very tedious very quickly.
So I'm curious to hear what you think of 2, because I always heard that people didn't really seem to think Dead Rising 2 was as good as the first one.
Even. So 2 is weird. My first immediate reaction to 2 versus 1 is it actually felt more confined. So 2, which is weird because it's outside, or a big portions of it are outside. But 2, 2 takes place in this mall. It's a huge shopping mall. It's open. You have the run of the place from the very beginning, and it's not like you're going from area to area. You're just in a big open mall. There are some parts where you can cross in other sections of the mall. You can go to the courtyard or whatever. But in general, you're in this one big hub area.
That's the first game,
right? The first game, yeah. In the second game, there is a mall. There's this big, like, fake Italian veranda. There's just stuff everywhere. It's basically an analog of Las Vegas. If you think about how in Las Vegas, they've recreated, like, streets of Venice and parts of Paris and giant malls. Mm-hmm. It's like that. But for whatever reason, it feels much more chunked up. Like these small units of space. So it feels a lot more like you're walking from place to place and then going through absurd amounts of load for a game I have installed on the hard drive. Completely installed on the hard drive because you download it. But mm-hmm. to me, the biggest issue that I had with it is just that it gives you some more direction by having these like really time-bound chapters where it's saying like, all right, on day 2, between the hours of 4 a.m. and 2 p.m., you need to investigate this. But it sort of boomerangs the game around by making this really time-bound, mission-based structure without making the game world itself conducive to that. It's still basically meandering around the poorly mapped world looking to get to the hotel lobby. And that is actually more distressing when you have time limits. Conversely, a lot of times you finish them really early, and one of the conceits is your daughter during the first outbreak was bit by a zombie and is on a drug that keeps her from turning into a zombie.
Zombrex.
But Zombrex. She has to take it every 24 hours at this exact time. So every day there's an objective to get her a vial of Zombrex. And when you give it, you have to give it to her at 7. You can't, like, if you get it at, like, 4 in the morning, you can't just drop it off and then go back out and do work.
This is sounding weirdly like Pikmin 3.
Really?
Well, yeah, you have to go get fruit juice every day or the game is over. And it's not that you have to return the fruit juice at a certain time, but at a certain time, the day just ends. And whatever you were doing is, you know, you drop it immediately and run back to the ship, so...
Yeah, but that's not really... I don't know. I don't think the situations are analogous. How do you say that?
Analogous.
Analogous. Because of juice fruit, you can actually stockpile for like 50 days. I had 60 days worth of fruit juice by the end.
Sure. I mean, but couldn't you find more than one vial of Zombrex and hold the second one for the next
day? No, because they're mission-based. So you get a mission that is, go find Zombrex. And I'd be like, there's Zombrex in the drugstore, but there's only one vial, even though it's a fucking drugstore. Like, there things like that, you just go like, eh. I also feel like the item selection's not as good as it was in the first game. I've been running around with
Yeah, but you're supposed to be combining items, right?
I mean, it's...
It was kind of my favorite aspect of the game. I haven't played the first one. I played the second one. And, yeah, just like... Like, you can electrify a rake just by taping a battery to a rake.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I get that there's a lot of options there, but the core items in the first game were just so much better. Like, I want to run around dressed like Mega Man and shoot shit. I want to do that. No, you can't.
Right.
You can do that in Tatsunoko versus Capcom.
You can.
Could you do that already, like, from the beginning?
Yeah, well, if you found the costume shop, pretty much, yeah. Like, so I've been running around with the Blanka mask on for most of the game. Just to give me something to do. But most of the time I've been fighting with, like, baseball bats and, like, broom handles. And, I mean, it just... Versus the previous game where I was, like, running around with a crossbow and a battle axe. It's like, come on! Let's go! Mega Man Crossbow Edition is gonna shit you shit. And it just doesn't have the same, you know, weird craziness of the first game. And in an attempt to fix the issue I had with the first game, they didn't actually fix the gameplay. They just sort of wrapped missions around it. I'm not a big fan of where they took it. And I think the whole game at this point is really, they need to really rethink what they're going to do with this franchise.
Yeah, I rented it for a weekend because I wanted to experience this franchise, and I don't have a 360. And I don't know, it felt like work.
A little bit. I think the model they need to use, and there's actually a good analog for this, which we talked about last week. There is a place in Saints Row the Third that becomes infested with zombies. Like, just a part of town. And when you go there, it's just zombies fucking everywhere. But they just die comically, and you just pour gunfire on them and kill thousands in seconds, and it's satisfying because of how powerless they are.
Yeah, some of those missions in Saints Row, I felt, went on for too long.
Right.
It wasn't really clear how to proceed sometimes.
Right.
But as part of the open world, there just being this kind of zombie neighborhood. You can go into it, kill some zombies, and then you can leave when you're ready.
Right.
I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, if that was more what it felt like, it was just a place that was infested with zombies, and you know, you could go get stuff out of houses and stuff and use them as weapons. That's great. But I think for me... I mean, I'm not interested at all in the third game for Xbox One/3.
Exclusive, I think.
It is exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
I think for me, ultimately, my favorite experience with the Dead Rising universe is going to be the character use in Project Cross Zone. Which is sad. Because he is amazing in that game.
All right, well, let's move on. Just a couple more games to talk about pretty quickly here before we wrap up new business. I wanted to mention Wario Land 3. I've talked about this game glowingly a number of times on the podcast over the years. I hadn't actually played it since about 1999 when it first came out. I think I bought it on launch day. I played the crap out of it. I think I beat it and got pretty much everything in it, and then I haven't played it since. So it's been a really long time, and it's out on Virtual Console now, and anybody who wants to can go pick it up for $5. And this was a Game Boy Color exclusive, so it only ran on Game Boy Color. And I guess GBA, but because of that, I feel like not as many people have played it as some of the other Wario Land games. And although it is very similar to Wario Land 2, I think it is so much better. It's so much more refined and optimized and streamlined and really.
I'm glad to hear that.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it totally is. The thing is, and I know some of your criticisms of Wario Land 2,
yeah.
Guillaume, and I think I understand them. The game can be a little aimless sometimes, and the other part is that, you know, the sort of map structure that you get where the levels sort of flow from one to the other is hard to read. It's very sort of obtuse. And actually, do you even see that before the end of the game? Do you have to sort of get to an ending first?
No, you have to beat the game first. Yep.
So the sort of non-linearity of Wario Land 2 is very, very much, it's sort of hidden and it's hard to understand. I don't know if that's deliberate or if that's just kind of the way things worked out. But in Wario Land 3, maybe it's the power of the Game Boy Color and of having developed it exclusively for that system. But they do a much better job of sort of showing you how the world is set up, showing you how all the levels are interconnected, and also showing you how things that you've done or things that you've found might affect how you can explore the world. And they do this through the world map, which is just so impressive. I mean, it's really amazing playing it now in 2013. I'm still impressed by the world map and just how dynamic and colorful and animated it is. And it's not just pretty, it's really functional because it tells you where the levels are and where it gives you a lot of indications in various ways visually of where you might want to go next. You know, and the game is definitely nonlinear. And if you don't have any patience for that, you won't like this game. If you hate backtracking, you will hate this game. But if you like going back into a level and finding that something you've learned or some new power that you have completely changes the path that you take through that level and opens up all these new areas that you didn't even, not only had you not played this part of the level, you didn't even know it was there because it was so well hidden. And now that you can bust blocks with your butt, you can play, I mean, the level just turns into something completely different. And in Wario Land 2, that stuff felt completely hidden and really, really obtuse. In Wario Land 3, the game will come out and pretty much show you, hey, there's something here you can do that you couldn't do before. It's much better about that. I think it's less frustrating. There's also a place on the map you can go where this character will tell you, here's the next level you should probably go to. So clearly something has opened up there, or you now have a power that you can use there to do something. So I think it really does a much better job of directing you. And it's just a really brilliant 2D platformer. It's so creative. In fact, in this game, you know, the big thing in Wario Land 2, the big innovation was all the enemies that would transform you right, rather than kill you. And in Wario Land 3, I think the level designs are so good, and the, you know, learning to use the different powers and learning how the levels connect to each other is so much fun that the whole enemy transformation aspect of it is almost in the way. I mean, it's done well, and they certainly have a lot of puzzles and platforming sections that, you know, that rely on it and use it in interesting ways. But maybe part of it is that a lot of those are similar to things you've already done in Wario Land 2. And the other part of it is, I might have talked about this before, but the Wario Land 2 and 3 both rely on sort of a nuisance factor as a punishment. Since you can't die, and in this game, you don't even really lose money when you get hit. Money is much less of an important factor in terms of actually like finding coins. You don't use them for very much. But also when you get hit, you don't really lose coins. So getting hit is really just kind of an annoyance. Like it knocks you back, or it makes you fall down a platform and now you have to climb back up the ladder.
Yeah, or you get flattened, right? Because I did actually own this for GBC.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember much of it, but I did own this.
Well, you could own it again remember, now and play through it again.
I just remember always getting flattened.
Yeah, you get flattened, and then you have to go find something that will stretch you back up, you know. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there are enemies who throw donuts at you, and they make you really fat, which means that you can break through blocks below you that you couldn't have before. You can also, when you jump and land, it makes the ground shake, and it will make things bounce upward, and in some cases they'll catch on a ledge, and so you can actually move enemies up a series of ledges by jumping and shaking the ground and making them bounce upward. It's really clever, but the problem is that if you get a donut when you didn't want to, you have to walk around for like 20 seconds until he works off the extra weight and he goes back to normal. Mm-hmm. And when that happens like 3 times in a row, because this enemy's in a really annoying place and all you care about is just getting past it, it's kind of like, can I just push a button to go invincible? You know, like I just want to get past this part. Yeah. And they certainly, you know, I mean, it takes skill and patience to get past that stuff like that. But a lot of the game, a lot of the enemy encounters are based around this idea that if you just blast through here, we're going to punish you the only way we know how, which is to make you waste a bunch of time before you can attempt this again. And the bosses are especially like that. Mm-hmm. And I understand that's sort of the natural conclusion of having a game where your character is invincible, but it's just kind of fucking irritating after a while. So the combat aspects of the game I don't like as much, but the traversal and the puzzle solving and the exploration especially, I really love. And I would certainly recommend it very, very highly.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really, really good. I just thought the jumping was a bit stiff. That's what I didn't like about it. The feel of the jumping was a little bit weird because I was kind of expecting very Mario, very quick, but it's not like that. It's just a little bit different.
Yeah, I think that's true of all the Wario Land games.
Yeah. Yep.
And for the bosses, though, you're a cheater. You've admitted. Have you used the save states? That kind of solves that problem, no?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, it takes a couple of seconds to load up a save state, but yeah, I mean, I just basically, you know, a lot of times what will happen is you climb up to this platform that's above the boss, and that's where I'll make the save state. And then you jump down and you fight the boss, and if the boss hits you, he'll knock you off the platform, and then you have to, like, swim through a bunch of shit and then climb long ladders to get back up to the top so you can try again.
Yeah.
And, of course, the damage resets every time this happens. So you really kind of have to play the bosses perfectly every time if you want to get through it without getting knocked off. So there's definitely an element of trial and error. Now, there aren't that many bosses in the game. So yeah, I mean, Wario Land 3, I think it's definitely better than 2. It's way better than 4, which I have a lot of problems with. And, you know, I think it's one of the best, easily one of the best Game Boy Color exclusive games that Nintendo ever released. There weren't very many of them, but this was always the standout. It was always the one to get. And, you know, if you haven't played it and you like offbeat 2D platformers, if you like the Wario series at all, I think you should really, really check it out on the 3DS Virtual Console. All right, so we're going to wrap up new business with one more game from Justin.
Yes, I've been playing Mario and Luigi Dream Team. I was a big fan of the series ever since the original. The only one I really didn't like before this was Partners in Time on the DS. Mm-hmm. Dream Team, so far, it's like a mood swing with it. I go from hating it to loving it and back to hating it. And basically, the points I hate are pretty much nonstop text and tutorials, and it really hammers you at the ton of them for, like, everything you do.
Yeah, but you knew you were getting a Mario and Luigi game.
But I don't remember this many tutorials in the other ones. Like, I feel like it would teach you, and then you'd go off. This one, I feel like I'm hit with a tutorial and, like, a lot of story, and it just doesn't stop. And then whenever I'm given some time to pretty much go off my own, that's when I'm really enjoying myself, exploring the world, getting in battles as I choose, but then it goes back to the story and it kind of feels like it drags on a bit at that point. So I have some fun, but the story's slowing it down a bit.
Quick question for you, Justin. Did you play Sticker Star Paper Mario?
Yes, I did play Sticker Star.
So that game came out less than a year ago. It was really like about 9 months ago, I think, that came out.
Yeah.
Do you feel that these, I mean, obviously they're sort of different franchises, but they're similar in a number of ways, Paper Mario and Mario and Luigi. And now for the first time, they're both on a handheld. Do you feel like they're similar enough that like you might have a little fatigue, or are they different enough that that hasn't really been a problem?
Well, I think if you're just comparing Sticker Star to Mario and Luigi, they're very different. I don't know how much of Sticker Star you played, but they're really
I beat it.
Yeah, but I did too. It was
so I played way more than I should have.
Yeah. I mean, Sticker Star was like not really an RPG, as it was just collecting stickers and using them. This is more, has all the RPG elements, so I think they are different enough. But overall, I prefer the Mario and Luigi series.
Yeah, me too.
I do think Thousand Year Door was amazing, though, as far as Paper Mario goes, but it's been a while since there's been a Paper Mario game that I enjoyed. Because I didn't like Super Paper Mario either.
Mm-hmm. Also, not really an RPG.
Yeah, I just didn't like that game. I got bored of it fairly quickly and moved on. But that's pretty much all I have to say about Mario and Luigi at this point. Like, it's fun at times and kind of annoying at other times.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what the reviews that I've read said. They said, yeah, this is pretty good at times, but my God, they just kill you with the tutorials. It's just endless. And they tell you the same thing over and over and over again in the tutorials.
I was kind of hopeful playing the demo because they let you skip some of that. Like, they were like, hey, do you want to hear about how to do this? And I was like, no. Okay, we'll tell you. And it went on. Like, I was so surprised. And I was hoping maybe the full game would be like that. You know, no, I don't want to hear how to, you know, crush boulders.
You guess what, Guillaume? Guess what?
Well, yeah, and it gets to the point where they actually ruin some of the puzzles for you, right? Because they kind of tutorialize sort of what you're supposed to do to solve every single puzzle all the way through the game.
At times, yes, but yeah. You can skip some of the tutorials, but then I've had one where I said I want to skip it, and then they're like, "Are you sure you want to skip it? We could really teach you something here." and then it just makes me wonder, like, well, maybe this one said that because there's actually something I'll learn here. And then you go through it, and you're like, I probably could have figured that out on my own anyway. And
yeah, it's like it
does seem like an extreme overreaction to Sticker Star and how obtuse and confusing it was, but. To me, the problem with Sticker Star wasn't that it was too difficult, it's that it was arbitrary. You know, like the fact that you had to purchase
just the boss
the item stickers, and you could only carry in a limited number of them, and yeah, in the boss battles, it's like you would have had to like have precognition of what the boss was going to be and how you needed to defeat him in order to, you know, carry the correct stickers into the battle in the first place. There's just a lot of issues with how that game is paced and also just the sort of the sequencing of the things. It's not that it's too difficult, it's that it's illogical, you know. It's that you almost have to read a guide to play that game, because otherwise I don't even know how you would ever even figure any of that stuff out. It's just really stupid. So I've never had that problem in Mario and Luigi, and it doesn't even seem really possible, because that game is more about just learning how the two brothers interact with each other and how, you know, how to use the abilities that you have to manipulate the world. But it's not based on this inventory system nearly so much as Sticker Star was. So it just seems unnecessary to over tutorialize Mario and Luigi. It's already a very simple RPG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just can't go back to the series. I played the demo, and okay, you still time your attacks, you still time your jumps, so that you know, do this, do that. It hasn't really evolved. Like, it was welcome initially when they came up with the system with Mario RPG. It was like, oh yeah, timed attacks. That's really novel. Mm-hmm. But it kind of tends to drag the battles a little bit, to make them drag on, I find. Like, if you miss, you're just like, ah, damn it, that means I have to go through another turn, and...
This game also has, like, an achievement-type system, I guess, for dodging attacks in each area, so if you dodge, like, 10 against, like, enemies in the desert area, for example, like, you get a check, and there's some gear that the more achievements you've completed, the more powerful it'll be.
Yeah, I think part of my issue with the way the Mario RPG series, both Paper and Mario and Luigi, have evolved from the original Mario RPG on Super Nintendo is just that in that game, all the timed button presses and everything really were enhancements to your attacks, or they would help you dodge. But if you missed it, or if you just didn't want to do it, you could still play that game. I mean, your attacks would still be effective. Your armor and everything would still protect you from attacks. It's just you might have to use more items to heal or whatever. And in a lot of the games since then, it feels like if you don't push the button at exactly the right time when the hammer goes over, you just won't even hit. I mean, your attack just won't even do any damage. And if you don't...
Well, that's something I like.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, see, I liked it when it's kind of when it was sort of a skill.
It takes out a lot of the RPG aspect of it, though. It makes it so that your stats don't really matter anymore.
Right, it's an action game at that point.
I think that's what I prefer, because I'm not the biggest RPG fan, but I think one of the things that appeals to me in the Mario & Luigi series is there's skill involved, and I don't feel like I'm just picking things out of a menu. I pick them, and then I have to actually do it. And I enjoy that, so...
Yeah, it's a continuum. It's definitely, these are definitely more on, they lean a lot harder on the action part and the statistics, the experience points, the strategy of which attacks you use and what items you use is less important than just executing it correctly every single time. And I guess you could look at it as being repetitive either way. I guess I would just, if it's going to be repetitive, I would prefer that the repetitive part be just really quickly thumbing through menus rather than have to go through this sort of laborious, you know, waiting for exactly the right moment and pressing the button. It's still repetitive over the course of a 40 hour game. It's just, it takes a lot more attention. And so I have less patience for it, I guess.
I'm with you.
I don't understand why they went this direction with the story in this one with Sleeping Luigi. I mean, I know it's the year of Luigi, but I doubt they planned it that way.
yeah.
I really think they should have had it with Wario and Waluigi. That's what I've wanted to see in this series, and I don't know why they're delaying that.
That would be amazing. The Wa Brothers. All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have part one of our retroactive feature on Pandora's Tower, and it will definitely be interesting. So stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a review for the highly anticipated Rayman Legends on Wii U, and that's written by Scott Thompson. A few years back, Ubisoft showed their commitment to 3DS by releasing a port of a port of a port of Rayman 2 on the platform right at launch. For the Wii U, they planned something far more grand, a 2D platformer heavily leveraged on the gamepad. In true Ubisoft fashion, it was delayed a million years, but it's finally out, and it's amazing.
We have Impressions, Shovel Knight for the Wii U by Curtis Bond. Delicious Mega Man, one of now many Mega Man-inspired retro games brought to us by Kickstarter. Curtis sees influence of the Blue Bomber all over the Blue Knight's helm.
I'm glad you got that in the beat poetry form. I was hoping you'd read it.
What's up with the Christopher Walken impression?
I was going for, what's his name, Shatner.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. He is Canadian.
Time to rock it, man. We have a review, The Wonderful 101 for the Wii U by Dan Koopman. Rainbow Rampaging Raging Rapscallions. Wonderful 101's here, and it's a barrage of bombastic brilliance. That was 101 characters, by the way.
I'm an artist, to make that clear. We have impressions. Shantae and the Pirates Cursed on 3DS by Curtis Bonds. Curtis has more packs hands-on time, this time with current WayForward employees. If I had a prehensile ponytail, I wouldn't use a pistol, but I don't work with pirates either.
Alright, some impressions for Tesla Grad on the Wii U by Curtis Bonds.
Curtis killing it this
week. Once more, into the breach for Mr. Bonds. This time he has impressions of an independent Metroidvania game. It's got a ways to go before it comes out, but the gravity gloves mean it should soar. Or hover. Whatever.
We awesome. Out!
And by the way, we also have the brand new issue number 9 of NWR Now Play, or NWR Powered Off. The PDF magazine version of our website, which is highly recommended. James, what did you write this month?
Unfortunately, I wasn't ready at time for print this month. Writer's block, man. Writer's block's hard.
Yeah, but there are some special features in there, and some really good artwork, and just a really nice layout. So check that out as well, along with even more PAX coverage from Curtis and lots of other stuff. It's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for Retroactive, and unfortunately, we did lose John Lindemann. He has not played the game yet. He is planning to for part two and coming up in a couple of weeks, so he's not going to be missing out on this Retroactive entirely, but he wasn't ready for it this time, and that's why we got Justin here. And Justin has played at least about as far as I have, basically the first two or three towers in the game, for a few hours into it. Guy is about halfway through. James beat the whole thing and has talked about it before on the show. And for this first part, since we're not trying to do the whole thing in one go, I figured we'll try to keep this a little bit shorter, and we'll kind of focus on the early parts of the game and first impressions. And that's sort of how I picked out some quotes from the forum thread also, is some people beat the game, gave some really great kind of long posts about, you know, sort of summing it up and looking a lot of different angles. I'm mostly going to keep those for next time when we talk about sort of the game as a whole. And I figured for this first part, I picked out some quotes from people who really were just starting the game when they posted in the forums. They're playing it for the first time. They're playing it because it's retroactive and not because they'd already had it. And they're kind of talking more about the early impressions or the early parts of the game. So that's going to be the focus this week. And I thought we should start off with sort of going back over the sort of the general premise of Pandora's Tower and talking about the story a little bit. James has described this before, much to our amazement and aghastment. I guess I'll take a quick stab at it here. It's a game where it's really kind of a relationship game. You're playing as this young man, and he's trying to cure this young woman of a curse that is slowly turning her into a monster. And he's doing that by going and fighting through these towers and facing off against bosses and pulling flesh from the monster's bodies, taking them back to the girl and feeding her, even though she's a vegetarian. Her whole society is vegetarian.
Fuck your plants.
And I can't believe they actually say that in the game. So it's very deliberately uncomfortable. And she has to eat this piece of flesh that has magical powers that help reverse the curse and keep her human for a little while longer. It's so bizarre that it really seeps into the game, and it's hard to think of this game without thinking of these weird cutscenes where you see this young girl holding a huge purple lump of meat and biting into it, and she's pretty much like crying as she does it, because definitely does not want to be doing this. I don't know if you guys watch Game of Thrones or have read the book, but there's a scene in the first book in the first season of the show where a character has to do something very similar. She has to like eat an entire horse heart. And I think it's like if she doesn't finish it completely without throwing up, they're going to kill her or something like that. So it's like a very stressful thing to like be forced to eat something that you don't want to eat. And it's just a weird thing to put in a video game story. And so the very first forum quote that I want to read here is from Fiendlord Timme, and he posted, "The scenes where Elena is transforming into the monster and has to eat the beast flesh are very unsettling, and I felt uncomfortable watching them. But I think that's exactly what they were going for, so I feel they succeeded in that regard." Do you guys agree that this is really intentional and that they're trying to set up a tone for the rest of the game? And do you think that's a good thing?
I mean, yeah, it's obviously intentional. I mean, not only is she, you know, opposed to eating meat, and it's a societal, I mean, it's basically stated that it is a societal sin, essentially, to go and just consume meat. They present her, she's this incredibly demure, just...
Very, very waify, sort of. Like she's small, she's thin, she looks very weak, and she's got this curse, so like she's just kind of physically not very
and she's,
imposing,
she's,
right?
I mean, and if you look at her before the curse really sets in, she's, you know, this really elegant sort of airy white dress. And
in the flashbacks, yeah.
Yeah, her hair is... I mean, she's this very kind of regal, but yet very, very meek character.
Mm-hmm.
And as the curse sets in, she turns into this hideous, hideous beast. I mean, her skin starts to turn into just covered in boils, and she begins to ooze. And
yeah, like there's a lot of writhing tentacles popping out.
Yeah.
A lot of appendages that don't seem to serve a purpose just sort of start splitting off from her in weird places.
Well, she's becoming the monsters that you're killing, essentially. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And as you feed her these really just fetid pieces of meat, I mean, they look as if they have sat out in the sun for eons.
And the game menus describe them as they're dripping, they're raw, they're smelly.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
I mean,
ugh.
it is what it is.
Yeah.
The game, I mean, this is... You couldn't do this by accident.
Do you think that's a good thing, though? I mean, do you think it really serves a purpose that's worth, you know...
Well, it kind of... I don't know how much we want to say, but I think that they're making a point, and perhaps it's going to turn into something else later.
Hmm. Okay.
I think, I mean, I know what happens with it, so I'm trying to be careful how I couch these terms.
Thank you.
But it's setting up this process of, you know, she's transforming into this really, really foul beast, and if she doesn't get her requisite intake of monster heart, she is going to become one of these monsters. So there's this sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't dichotomy that they really play up by making both options tremendously grotesque.
Yeah, you have to do something bad to keep something bad from happening.
Right, and it's not even immediately clear that what you're doing is significantly better than what is happening.
Hmm.
Because you're killing these monsters that really aren't doing anything. You're basically just going like, I'm going to fuck you up.
Yeah, there definitely are echoes of Shadow of the Colossus in the way that the story is set up and
right.
in the feeling that you're never really quite sure if what you're doing is the right thing. I mean, you're doing the only thing the game will allow you to do. Like, you can't progress if you don't kill these monsters.
Right.
For the purpose of reviving or curing this girl who you're in love with, but you're not really sure if it's ethical at any point. And the game does seem to play with that.
Yeah, I mean, these monsters are not hurting anybody. They live in this tower in the rift, and they more or less are protecting the chain that keeps the rift together. I mean, but that's all they're doing. They're just sitting there. And there is this sort of, they speak about it in kind of undertones, and I'm not too worried too much about spoiling it, is that the rift that these towers are in is being held together by a fucking chain.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire time, to get to these monsters, you are severing chains.
Right. So you've got these big chains that are strung throughout the levels, and I actually really like this aspect. It reminded me of some of my favorite Zelda dungeons, where you're sort of tracing the path based on these environmental cues, where you can see the chain and it's part of the level, and you basically you follow that, and it guides you to where you need to go.
Right. Yeah, the level design is really smart that way, because I find that even though it doesn't feel like the game is linear, I'm never really lost. I always know where I'm going. And it's just fantastic that they've achieved that.
And when you step into the main chamber of every dungeon, you see all three chains that bind the dungeon together. I mean, they're all right there for you to see.
It's two in some of the earlier ones.
Yeah. The statue at the front of the stage is holding the chains.
Well, I think that the chains that you have to destroy in order to open the boss door, they serve another purpose, because this game uses fixed camera angles, kind of like Eternal Darkness or Resident Evil, or God of War, to be fair. And, you know, those games tend to be a little more linear, a little more straightforward. Like, God of War in particular is not an exploration game. You know, hardly ever would you go through the same room more than once. And so in those cases, I think, you know, having a somewhat dynamic but essentially fixed camera angle that just sort of follows you or just shows the room from a certain angle is fine, because you know where you were before and you know where you haven't been yet, so it's pretty clear. In this game, there is some backtracking. The rooms do tie into each other in multiple ways. There are shortcuts. You know, it is more like a Zelda dungeon in that way. It's more non-linear, and having those fixed camera angles could make it very disorienting. And I think having the chain there is really useful in giving you a sort of linear path from point A to point B, even though you're kind of in one room, you're going from the background to the foreground, another room, you're going from the bottom left to the top right, and the camera's just staying there. And, you know, it's a strange way to portray the game. And I think with the kind of game that it is, it could be very problematic, but they've done some smart things like the chain to help you, sort of keep it all together and keep it straight.
And splitting the chain actually will sometimes give you, you know, it'll take a room that was bisected and make it so now it's an open space.
Hmm.
And it gives you these big shortcuts through the level.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, to me, to get to the point we were discussing of, you know, is all this visual symbolism, you know, really important? I think, to me, when I was playing the game the first time, my biggest fear was not her turning into a monster, which I always felt like I had control, and I was never running her close to the time limit where it was a problem. It was the reality that this big giant rift that they stopped from spreading by chaining up, I'm kind of fucking with all this. Is this really a good idea? And it's kind of a third grotesque facet of what the equation you're working is.
Yeah, because basically you're following the advice of this woman, this really creepy woman, Mavda, and the the game is not told in a linear fashion. Like, initially, you start a game, you don't really know the relationships of these characters, you know, right, to one another. And then the more you see the cutscenes that are flashbacks, the more you realize, oh, wait, okay, so he's in love with the girl. Sure, we knew that. But this woman, they've only encountered after the curse hit the girl. And yeah, they really, like, she just happened to know about the curse. And she's like, follow me.
Well, and she's a spell weaver who has a cursed monster basically as her traveling companion.
Yeah. That confused me at first because I thought that was part of her at first until I played a little longer. And then I'm like, oh, okay, it's like actually a separate...
It's a separate entity.
Yeah, I thought it was like somehow part of her at first, but...
I saw someone in the forums theorize that it could be her dead husband, that she's sort of reanimating and carrying around.
That was kind of the impression I got at first, but maybe not. I think she jokes about that at some point, but
I
don't recall.
I mean, she makes jokes about him relatively frequently. But of course, keep in mind, she's also the only one who can understand him.
Yeah. I do kind of like her as a counterpoint, or maybe even like an expansion of the idea of the mask salesman in Majora's Mask. You know, like this very creepy character, you're not really sure if you can trust this person, and they have a lot of aspects that are very unsettling, and you know, you have to deal with them, you have to work with them to beat the game, but you don't necessarily like going up to them and having to encounter them.
Into an even more extreme scenario of the mask salesman, it's not immediately clear that Mavda isn't responsible for this.
Right, yeah, you don't know her involvement.
At least in the case of the mask salesman, you just felt his irresponsibility may make him involved here, but you know he didn't give it to the Skull Kid and say, go buck wild, son!
Yeah, but he's clearly involved. And by the way, another great example of this is the merchant in Resident Evil 4.
Yeah.
Super creepy dude, but you're not beating that game unless you go work with him a lot. Right. So every time you need something, you have to, it's like, it's almost like the game is daring you to go talk to this guy. It's like, I don't, he kind of creeps me out and he looks like a monster, but he's not, I guess, I don't know. And his voice and.
Yeah. I mean, the really disturbing part of the Mavda relationship is you're constantly leaving her in Mavda's care. You're like,
right. Yeah. She stays behind with Elena while you're off in the towers.
It's like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this.
Right. The game doesn't tell its entire story through cutscenes and flashbacks. You also find these files in the towers. Sometimes they'll explain, there'll be like the diary of some engineer in the tower explaining some, you know, very heavy-handedly like what the weakness of a boss is. But at other times, like you find these documents about this wandering tribe that seems to be where Mavda is from. And,
it is Mavda's tribe, yes.
Right, and they were, like, they're wandering because they've lost their country, and they're kind of, you know, they're definitely part of these towers. They've played a role there, and you realize that they might have ulterior motives as...
And it's quite explicit, they lost their country because of shit they were doing.
Right. So yeah, like, you definitely know that you can't trust her, but I'm surprisingly engaged by the story. I can't wait to see where it's going.
Yeah, it is definitely an interesting setup.
And to make the relationship with her even more fucking sketchy, besides the fact that they're responsible for the downfall of their own country, they're also heavily leveraged with these magical chains that, oh, look an awful lot like the ones that are binding the world together.
And the one that Mavda gives you as your
weapon. Yeah, it's like... How fucked up is their relationship with this stuff?
So, Justin, I know that you said you weren't really that crazy about Pandora's Tower from the few hours that you played of it. Would you say that all the stuff that we're talking about now, like the story and the sort of atmosphere and the kind of creepiness of it, did that play into it? Or are your criticisms mostly more sort of mechanical?
I mean, the story didn't really grip me in a way that I wanted to keep going. I kind of got bored. But it was not the... The setting wasn't so bad, but I could see how that would turn a lot of people off. My sister walked by, I was playing it during one of the beast flesh eating scenes, and it was like, what the hell are you playing?
Delicious. Yeah.
So I can understand why some people might be turned off from that, but overall the story didn't really excite me much. It seemed kind of generic in some ways, but I see how, with you guys talking about how it gets a little different the further you go, it kind of intrigues me a little more, but as far as I got, it didn't really make me want to continue.
Yeah, I don't know that the plot itself is really all that dynamic, but there's a lot of backstory that is surprisingly rich, and you're not going to get that right off the bat, but I've definitely seen hints of it.
Well, it never actually gives you this stuff. Well, I mean, later it does. But a lot of the stuff is given to you in little chunks that you have to make the final jump to tie it all together. Like, you know Mav is a member of this tribe. You find documents about how this tribe got wiped out. And then you kind of get these hints that they were doing some dark shit with monsters. And then you realize, well, Mavda has a fucking spirit hanging around on her back. You're like, oh, this isn't great. And then you have a tower of man-made monsters you're fighting. You're like, oh, yeah, great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I think the story does seem pretty interesting, and I do appreciate the sort of creepy slash unsettling or just kind of gross vibe that they establish right from the very beginning. But I do have to say, it kind of, the world of this game, or just the experience of playing it, is, it makes it unpleasant in a way that has sort of impacted my desire to play it.
Really?
You know, yeah, I mean, I think it's fun, you know, and I like the levels, and I'm interested to play it. I'm interested to learn more about what is going on here, but there is a certain, macabre factor to it, maybe, that just, I don't know. It could also be the stress of having the timer. I think that is an element as well that some people in the forums were complaining about. But it's not necessarily a world I want to go hang out in, you know? Like, I do think, the games that this is most often compared to are, you know, stuff like Eco and Shadow of the Colossus. I mean, those games have very dark stories as well, but there's also something kind of stately about the environments and about the whole tone of those games. There's something a little more elegant, and I feel like Pandora's Tower is grimy and it's bloody and just kind of gross in a way that very few video games are.
You know, one thing the game does that it doesn't seem like it's a big deal and it shouldn't be, is that when she bites into this stuff, or when you slay a monster, oftentimes the blood's like purple instead of being red. And for whatever reason, that's really just extra gross.
It's worse.
I've had...
Yeah, like if it was like in the past when they replaced blood with other colors, it was like, all right, whatever, that's just dumb. They're just palette swapping blood colors. But for whatever reason, purple just works on me so much worse than red would. I think because it red, it would just seem cartoonish. But with this, just... this is just purple fluid. It's just like, that's probably blood. It could be bile. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's really gross.
I don't, you know, like, I know exactly what you're talking about, Johnny. Like, some games have worlds that I absolutely don't want to go back to, you know, like, it's just too bleak, but I'm not having...
Eternal Darkness?
No, actually, I like that. I don't know, like, no game comes to mind at the moment, but... Anyway, like, Pandora's Tower, I find the game to be beautiful, and I find the story engrossing, the backstory, and I just, I gotta, maybe it's all the bloom lighting or whatever it is, but the towers are really pretty, you know, like the water one.
I mean, they're beautiful.
Yeah. And, I'm not finding this kind of, like, barrier to my enjoyment. This game is right up my alley, visually and mechanically.
So on this topic, Leah's dad posted in the forums, said, "This game is reminding me a whole lot of the first Devil May Cry back on PS2, and I don't think that's a good thing. The look of the tower, the empty dreariness, the combat, replacing a chain with a sawed-off shotgun, I'm not happy about that."
I am more reminded of Prince of Persia, really.
Yeah.
Now that's much more of a, like, that's much more a game about beauty and, you know, sort of aesthetic pleasure, you know, like you said, the bloom lighting in Prince of Persia. Like, I feel like Prince of Persia, a lot of the environments in those games, have, you know, a lot of times there'll be open ceilings or there'll be holes in the ceiling where the sun shines through.
Right.
And so even though the place you're in might be somewhat dark, and I mean, those games are also full of like hallways with like spinning saw blades and stuff. Like, there's lots of kind of dark, dreary parts of it, but they do a pretty good job of keeping you engaged. And even when you're in an internal environment, they make you feel like you have a window to the outside.
Maybe it's just like the fact that the Prince of Persia games evoke kind of dreams, you know, and I'm finding this kind of same quality in Pandora's Tower.
I think you're going through these ruined architectures, because, I mean, although stuff is quite
old, it's not ancient, but this ruined architecture that's unnecessarily ornate, and you can kind of feel it. Like, you look around, there are these really opulent statues built, you know, just to hold a chain, or there's these just soaring, you know, arches that you walk through. I think a lot of that same stuff comes through Prince of Persia. It's ruined, and yet the inherent beauty of the craftsmanship of the world. Like, you're walking through what, if it was a real place, would be, you know, just striking. Like, you would be just awestruck going through it. There's so much detail that it's the same feel you get. And the fact that it's ruined makes it feel more otherworldly. It's weird, because there's just so much macabre stuff going on in here. And yet most of the levels are actually quite beautiful. Like, they're not dark in and of themselves. It's what resides in them that made them dark.
Yeah, it's just also the knowledge that these places were once populated. And then you read these diaries that have very much the same kind of tone to them as the diaries that you'd find in Resident Evil, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are dead people's diaries.
They start quite high and get quite dark.
Yeah.
And you can see the unwinding of the world that once resided in this place. I mean, it's laid bare to you on every single dungeon. Like, this was once a place of great beauty that has become a place of great darkness.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a weird parallel for what's happening with your monster transforming girlfriend.
Well, we've talked, gotten a lot of good mileage out of the aesthetics of the game. Let's talk a little bit more about mechanics. And one of the interesting things about Pandora's Tower is that you play with a Wii Remote and Nunchuck, and you're using the pointer quite a lot. Or you can play with classic controller. I just tried that for the first time last night. And I know Neil wrote in his review for the site, he wrote that he played through most of the game on a classic controller.
Yeah,
and
I played it exclusively on the Pro.
Really?
Really. So yeah. You never had problems with, like, precision of moving this cursor around with the right joystick?
Not really. Hmm. I did try it out with the Nunchuck and the Wii Remote, but I used the classic controller.
Interesting.
I didn't use a lot of the shooting, though. I was very much more melee-oriented.
Yeah, but the chain is so integral to, you know, like, really... hitting specific parts of the monsters and during the boss fights.
Yeah, I didn't have a big problem with that, no.
I played mostly with the Wii Remote and Nunchuck. I tried the classic controller, but only for about 5 minutes I got kind of frustrated and switched back.
Yeah, I get the feeling I would have the same reaction as I did when I tried playing with the gamepad, Pikmin 3. It's just like, what the hell? Like, there's one stick here that's too much, and I can't wrap my head around this somehow, and pointer and Nunchuck all the way.
Oh, for me, it's not the presence of a second joystick being a...
No, but it's so much clunkier.
Yeah, it's slower, it's less precise. I started Pandora's Tower with the Wii Remote because I didn't even know it supported classic controller. I must have forgotten. And then I read people talking about it in the forums. I read Neil's review. I was like, oh, wow. I figured I would try it because I remember, like, No More Heroes 2... They added classic controller support, and it made the game play very differently. And I actually kind of like the pacing of it. It actually felt faster in that game. So I figured, well, I want to try this. And I plugged it in last night. It really, like, almost immediately just did not feel as good. And I think it's a game where, you know, you do have this kind of hookshotty kind of chain that you use in your combat a lot. And it can be directed pretty much anywhere on the screen. And it seems like that's used a lot in the puzzles. There's, items that are, like, stuck on the walls that you can peel off with your chain if you point at it. And you can do all this stuff with the classic controller, but it involves, you know, moving a cursor all the way across the screen by holding down the joystick. And it's just not, I found it very hard to put the cursor where I wanted while I was also moving the character around. Because the character is moving in 3D space, but that cursor is on a 2D plane that overlays the screen. And I just found it really hard to coordinate between those two things. I beat the second boss while using the classic controller, and that was okay because the boss is fixed in the center of the screen. So if I move the cursor over where his weak point is, where I needed to use the chain, I could just kind of leave it there as I moved around. And if I moved too far over to the side of the screen and the cursor moved off, I could just kind of flick it over just a little bit and correct it. And I wasn't having to like move it. I wasn't having to making like dramatic movements of the cursor in order to get the chain where I wanted. But where I got really frustrated was when I was fighting the smaller enemies and they're jumping around, they're jumping out of the water and like trying to dive kick on me. And you know, I might be trying to pull an item off of one that's been defeated while this other one is over here trying to attack me and I'm trying to dodge him. I found that stuff really difficult with the classic controller.
And the fact is that the controls are simple enough to work on a nunchuck and a Wiimote. At the they're not dumbed down. You know, like there is a fighting system here, but it's not, you know, like combo based. It's not, you know, several different types of attacks. It's more about timing and, that kind of stuff you can easily pull off with just the A button and the Wii Remote, you know?
Yeah, I think it's based on timing and also location. So like where you are relative to where the enemies and the platforms are, that has a lot to do with it. And there's some strategy also in like, when do you use the chain and what do you, you know, how do you use it? Cause I say the game gives you a lot of options for using the chain. There's a lot of different mechanics you can play around with. And, it's a nice way to kind of mix up the combat and definitely, certain chain moves seem to work a lot better on some enemies than others.
I do want to say that that's one of the reasons I got kind of fed up with the game a little bit, is it did give you way too many options and way too quickly. So I felt like I didn't really have a time to master any of them, and I never really knew which option would be best in which situation, and sometimes I'd forget how to do certain things, and just a little too much.
Yeah, the game has a lot of tutorials, and I found myself not really able to actually pull off the things that it was telling me to do when they told me to do it. You know, like it would always take a couple of, you know, like a dozen minutes more. Like I would have to try it again at some later time. Like the tutorial would keep coming up when I would be in this room. And at some point I finally got, okay, that's what they want me to do. Like the whole thing where you can kind of repeatedly send the hook on an enemy, like up to six times. If you time the, like on the reticle, there's these four lights. And if they're all converging, then that's like the right timing to kind of repeat this attack again and again. Anyway, like I'm being a little bit too specific, but like that kind of stuff, I didn't even know what the tutorial was talking about initially, you know, and it took a little bit of trial and error.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. I'm wondering if I'm just not far enough to have seen that, or if maybe it tried to tell me how to do that and I didn't understand and I just totally passed it by.
The tutorials could use a little bit more work, in my opinion. They're not super clear.
All right, so we're kind of wrapping up the segment here for this week, but I had one more forum post I wanted to throw out there. Actually, a couple real quick. First, from Gwellen. Gwellen posted, Pandora's Tower does have the feel of a 3D Castlevania. The timer added a lot of stress to the game until I realized that all I need to do is find a good place to get meat, then focus on opening shortcuts. And I wanted to read this post because I thought, first off, the 3D Castlevania comparison is really interesting. I mean, that's a... Maybe not, a lot of people would say that's not a very favorable comparison. It's not a very nice thing to say about the game. I don't know what Gwellen's intention with that is. It's kind of out of context, but I would agree. I mean, I think in some ways this game works a lot better than some of the actual 3D Castlevania games, primarily because there's no jumping. So it has some of the atmosphere of a Castlevania game, and the fact that you're using this chain, it definitely, I see the similarities quite a bit. But I think mechanically it's a lot different because it is more puzzle focused and sort of more exploration focused, and it's not really a platformer.
No, I mean, to me, when I played this game, I think the references I made on the show were, I got weird Zelda vibes out of it, even though it uses fixed camera and it's more action-y than most Zelda games. It was just this, it was in no way a platformer. It was really just sort of a move through the world kind of game. I mean, in Zelda, they took that to the extreme of Link jumping for you. But in this game, they just forego jumps altogether for the most part.
No, the jumping works, I think, exactly the same way in Zelda. You can run off a ledge, and if you're moving when you do it, then he will kind of make a little running leap off of it, and maybe you jump over the river if the gap is short enough. And then also you can climb up onto boxes just by walking up to them and holding.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Toward the box, and you sort of scramble up the side of it.
Jumping is so non-issue, I don't even think about it.
Right,
this game.
Yeah. It's not really platforming, it's just a way to get across. Yeah.
It's a visual representation of a barrier.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, usually there's not really any risk of falling off a ledge, except that in the water temple, that really took me by surprise. I kept falling in the water because the enemies would knock me in there. So that's something to look out for.
Yeah, that's kind of annoying. Hmm. So one last forum post this week, Chuckles said, "Overall, the presentation is pretty nice. I like the art style and character design, except Aaron, who looks like a complete tool.
A little bit.
That opera piece that plays throughout is great, and the final boss variation, which I heard before ever playing the game, makes me want to pick up the score." So I wanted to read this just because we haven't talked about the music yet, and I think it's worth talking about.
Yeah, it's good.
Another person said that they felt like there's not enough music. Like, a lot of the time, the soundtrack is sort of silent.
I think that is the soundtrack, though. I think being quiet a lot of times forces Aaron to sort of be alone with his thoughts as he goes through this place. Mm-hmm. I mean, because he really is alone. He can't trust Magda. I mean, she's completely untrustworthy. And the only person he does trust is turning into a monster, both physically and mentally. I mean, she is being corrupted. He's really out there on his own.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess when you do have these moments of silence, it makes the music that much more dramatic when they pull it back in. And from what I've heard, the compositions are really, really
nice.
There's some parts, I want to say the opening title screen song almost reminds me of a certain Final Fantasy theme, but I can't think of which one it is.
Oh, no, now that you've mentioned it. Yeah. Shit.
But that's always a nice comparison in your head when something reminds you of Final Fantasy music.
Yeah.
Of which there's an entire game just based around the music from that franchise.
Yeah, I guess you could wish for a different theme for every dungeon, because it's true that they seem to repeat. Or if there is a difference, I don't notice.
They do repeat. But, I mean, it's still, you know, its own thing, you know. The music itself is, I don't know, it doesn't bother me because it's so background.
Yeah, I think the sound effects are more the centerpiece in this game, because you've got all the kind of gross stuff of eating the meat and pulling things out of the bodies of dead monsters and stuff like that. And there's some sound effects that go along with the timer also. And there's the typical sort of grunts of combat and of climbing around on boxes and stuff. But from what I've heard so far, I think the music is really, really nice.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, going through it, I've actually listened to the soundtrack of it, and it doesn't work quite as well outside the context of the game. And, you know, there are games where the soundtrack works really well on its own, and games where it works really well in conjunction. But it's still really nice. I think if you listen to it removed from the game, you might not go, "Ooh, that's really cool." But there are some songs, like the opening theme is a really good example of one where you're just like, "Ooh, ooh."
Yeah, I like that song, but I don't really remember the rest. But it's been a while since I've played the game, so.
It makes a good first impression.
Definitely.
And the last story did that as well. I remember in Xenoblade, the other Operation Rainfall game, it took a while before I started to hear the brilliance of the soundtrack for that game.
See, there's a mistake there, though, because if you don't hit start on the opening menu of Xenoblade, you just let it play, and you go through the whole day-night cycle on the opening screen, I think that's...
That's what I did when I first got it.
I think that's one of the most brilliant pieces of music composition I've heard in a game in a long time.
Yeah, it's really
so
amazing in
that game.
It's
incredibly subtle, all the little things that song is doing. It's doing key shifts that sort of indicate stuff's going on. It tells a narrative as the song goes up and back down. It partners that with the day-night cycle of the opening screen. It's a remarkable song.
But I think the whole soundtrack of that game is amazing.
It's unbelievable. I mean, all three of these games have really, really amazing soundtracks. And they're all really distinct as well. I mean...
Yeah. Cool, guys. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up for now. Like I said, in 2 weeks on episode 351, we're going to pick back up Pandora's Tower and wrap up the discussion with John back in tow. And we'll be talking about basically the whole game, so the later sections as well as just sort of a more broad overview of what we thought of it and what we liked about it and maybe didn't like about it.
Yeah, I really hope more people play because I'm really, really loving this game. It's right up my alley. Like, I do love games like this where you've got the nunchuck and the Wiimote and you can do independent actions, you know, with them. And things like Prince of Persia on a Wii worked so well. And I was a big fan of Lost Winds and things like that. And this is, it does a lot of smart things with the interface. And it's a good game, you know, in its own right, you know, like a lot of people who don't really know the Wii library would lament that, oh, it's all mini games. Well, this is a serious game.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing mini game about Pandora's Tower.
Serious game for serious game.
Yeah, and big boys game. And it does a lot of smart things with the interface, and it really uses the Wii, in my opinion, to its full potential, like control wise, unless you're using the dual stick for some reason.
Very high praise. All right. Well, that's going to wrap up the segment and the episode. So definitely want to thank Justin very much for coming by and helping us out, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to be here, man.
And other than the obvious Nintendo Collector's Journal that you do, the video series on the website, do you have anything else you'd like to plug or any other places that that or any other content you've been producing that people should check out?
Yeah, I just put up a Pokemon editorial talking about my most wanted changes to the series that I'd like to see in X and Y, so you could check that out. That's on the website right now.
Kill them all. Yep. Kill off every Pokemon.
Johnny wants to be no Pokemon. You just wander around an animalless world.
All you need is Mewtwo. That's the game will be perfectly balanced. It'd be great.
Everybody has six Mewtwos.
That's what I did in Red and Blue. So I talk about that in that editorial.
Everybody has six level 100 Mewtwos.
Because he was so broken in that game. That
Oh, he's so broken. He's the worst.
He was. It was awesome, and then they ruined it. But
all right, man. Well, I'll have to go check that out. Of course, the retroactive forum thread is open. It's definitely not too late to start playing the game and catch up and get your thoughts in there. And, you know, just I think it's just more fun to follow along with the discussion here on the podcast if you've played the game a little bit. And Pandora's Tower is pretty affordable. It's a little bit harder to find recently, but it's definitely, there are plenty of copies still out there, and it's out in every region. So if anything we said made you kind of perk up and made you interested, I hope you will check it out, and maybe you can even do it in time to participate before this feature is over. And a couple last things. We are still taking listener emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And actually, we're probably going to be going through quite a bit of email next week. So obviously, next week is our big 350th episode. We didn't really do anything special around the 7th anniversary of the podcast back over the summer. It was just things were a little too crazy. There was too much going on with E3 and travel and stuff like that. And so I just decided I would wait. And even with 350, we're not going to go super crazy with it, but we'll do a couple of special things maybe. And, you know, I definitely want to use that opportunity to focus on the fans and the listeners a little bit and get more of your comments and questions on the air. So if there's anything you would like to say to us, anything you want to ask about the podcast, anything you want to ask about Nintendo and video games, please send that in. And as always, there will be an email link on the website as well on the article for this podcast. So
anything you want to ask about John, anything, I'll answer.
That's right. So you can find the show notes for this episode as well as many other great podcasts and a lot of really good content over at NintendoWorldReport.com, and we will see you there. Until next time, this has been Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Later, guys.